Hey everybody, this is Marshall Latham here, coming in before the podcast to let you know that this episode of Outfield Excursions was actually released on the Patreon for this show back in February. And the latest episode of the Outfield Excursions, where Rish and I talk about Space Hunter Adventures in the Forbidden Zone, just went up on Patreon. And you can go listen to it now. All you need to do is go to patreon.com/journeyinto. And pledge $1 a month to the podcast, and you can immediately have access to that new episode, as well as a lot of other extras that I've been putting up there on the Patreon. That'll also give you early access to all of the episodes of the Journey Into podcast, sometimes a day or two early, sometimes a couple months early, and some things never come out on the regular feed. So if you want to support the podcast, head on over to Patreon and throw me $1. But right now, go ahead and listen to this episode. I think you'll enjoy it. Here it is. Welcome to the second official episode of the Outfield Excursions, where Rish and I talk about movies, not just Star Wars, but other movies that we've seen, and kind of do a little bit of a critique, a little bit of an explanation of it, and what our observations were and what we liked, didn't like, that kind of thing. So, due to the poll on the Patreon page, which did receive some votes, we were supposed to be talking about Space Hunter Adventures in the Forbidden Zone, but I can't find a streamable or easy to get to copy. I've looked in my library and I didn't find it there, and I don't know if you've had any luck or if you've looked for it, Rish, but
well, I was hoping that we could find it streamable on Netflix, and if not, we would check out the disc, but it didn't seem to be on there.
Yeah, I looked in lots of different places and couldn't find it. So, still working on that one. I still want to do that episode because it looks like a deliciously strange and errant movie. But so, we thought instead of delaying these episodes on the Patreon that and talking about some of the movies we've seen, we decided, as we're looking for Space Hunter Adventures in the Forbidden Zone, I think, Rish, this is one that you had suggested that we talk about. And so today we're going to talk about Dracula Untold. And you had seen it and we decided that we were going to talk about it here. And so then I got it from Netflix and have now watched it. I appreciate your patience in waiting for me to finally watch it.
Yeah, I was super anxious when I rented this because I started watching it and there will be plenty of spoilers in this episode, so if you have any interest in seeing Dracula Untold, I suggest you go ahead and watch it before we talk about it, and then come back before I finish this sentence, because I called you about halfway through the movie, going on and on about just, wow, this is really, really solid. You need to see this movie. And then after our phone call, I went back downstairs and finished the movie, and it was all downhill from there. So I think if I had spoken to you after the movie was over, I might not have encouraged you quite so much to see it. But yeah, we'll get to that. But before we even begin, I just wanted to tell this story. I told it on the Doonstief years ago, but I wanted to tell it to you. My buddy Chris married a girl from Romania, and they moved out to Los Angeles the same time I was living in LA, and they would invite me over to their house from time to time. And she was this lovely girl with a Romanian accent. She was fluent in English, but she still had a little bit of an accent. And she found out that I was really, really into horror, and we started talking, and she brought up Dracula. And it blew my mind to hear what this Romanian girl had to say about Dracula. Because she said that was one of the things that was most shocking to her when she came to this country, was the vilification of Vlad Tepish, as she called him. And she's like, I came here and everything is Dracula is this monster. Dracula is this devil. Dracula is, he's on a cereal box. He's on Sesame Street and he's obsessed with counting. And she's, and I was just like, well, so you didn't have Dracula in Romania? I mean, that's crazy. I mean, that's where he's from. And she's like, no, we had Dracula, but for us, he's like, and she tried to come up with a comparison. She said, he's like George Washington is to you Americans.
Wow.
Vlad the Impaler protected Romania, protected Wallachia from the invasion of the Turks. And the Turkish Empire was this unstoppable force that was going to roll over all of Europe. But Vlad stopped them. And Vlad saved all of Europe. He's a hero. He's not some kind of monster. And I laughed and I was just like, but what does Vlad Tepish mean? Because I knew. I'm a big horror fan. And she says, son of the dragon, yes. And I was like, I had heard that it was something else. And she's like, well, depending on who called him Vlad Tepish, it was son of the dragon or son of the devil. She said, but of course he was the impaler. Of course he terrified the Turks. That's how he got them to leave us alone. And anyway, she talked a little bit about, I guess in school, they don't vilify this guy. He is somebody who is a hero to them. And that made my mind real. It really, really did.
That's a totally different perspective, for sure.
But I saw this movie, Dracula Untold, and it was from, what year was this from? Any idea?
This is 2014.
Yeah, it's really recent. And this is the first movie I've seen, and I've seen tons of Dracula movies, but this is the first one that backs up my friend Chris's wife's story. He is the defender of Transylvania, of Wallachia is what they called the country back then. And he does everything that he can to save his people from the Turkish Empire. And he is the impaler, but they make it seem like he had to be. He had to do these things because the alternative was much, much worse. And so to me, I was just like, wow, that what a unique perspective for a movie to be told. And the vampire thing comes later. It's an origin story like a Marvel Comics origin story.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I felt like I was watching a superhero movie.
It has so much in common with a superhero origin story, where there's a man who's facing unbeatable odds, and he discovers a way to save his people through getting superpowers, essentially. I mean, do you want to tell the plot of the story, or do you want me to?
Well, I can give it a shot. I mean, I was interested when I got on the little envelope you get from Netflix. It gives the little synopsis of what the movie's about. And I don't think this one is necessarily representative, but it says, blending elements of history and vampire mythology, this new look at the life of the legendary Dracula explores his origin, from his first foray into darkness to his ultimate evolution as a blood-sucking fiend.
That is funny.
Because, yeah, I mean, blood-sucking fiend, that they really don't emphasize that. I mean, yes, he thirsts for blood, and, you know, that's part of the mechanism to kind of getting him through these things. He does defend his country from the Turks, but it talks about how he was given over to the Turks as a slave. All, like, 1,000 young men, and he was one of them, were basically slave soldiers to the Turks, and they were raised being whipped and tortured and basically beaten into submission and obedience to be these soldiers. And as you talked about, he rose in the ranks and became one of the most fierce soldiers of the Turks, and he did impale the his foes and leave them as a marker for people to see. And I think we'll talk about one of the scenes where he's talking about why he did that, but then eventually he goes back and becomes, he is the prince of the land. I think they say Transylvania in the movie. And he has 10 years of peace, but then the Turks come back and they're demanding again that they give up 1,000 of their sons to be soldiers for the army of the Turks. And he tries to reason with them and say, hey, I'll come back. I'll be your soldier again. But the person who's now the leader of the Turks, who I guess he grew up with as a young boy and fought with, it has nothing to do with it. And he says, and I want your son as well, because he's, Dracula is married and has a son. And so I don't know how detailed we want to get, but he's on the verge of giving up his son and all the sons. But at the last minute, he changes his mind and kills the emissaries that come to get his son, which basically declares war on the Turks, and he knows that they're coming. But previous to that, when he was searching out the Turk scouts, he traced them back to this cave up in this high mountain and found out where the Turk scouts were, but they were all killed. They were all dead. And the two men he was with were killed also. And there was this beast in the cave, and it almost sounded like a werewolf the way they depicted it. But as he got out into the sunlight and exposed his silver sword, the creature, who you got to see his face, and he looked more like a vampire kind of thing. But knowing that this guy was there, and knowing that he had great power and he had killed all these Turks, he went there seeking for power and wanted to know the secrets of this guy. So instead of getting killed, this monster, who is a vampire, says, you returned. Nobody's ever returned. And so he's intrigued and sees this as a hope. And well, no, he sees hope within Dracula. And so Dracula tells him what he wants and what he needs. And so he says, well, if you drink of my blood, you will have my powers and you'll know what it's like to be me. But you will thirst for blood, and if you satiate that hunger, then you will take my place and be a vampire for eternity. But if you last the 3 days and don't consume human blood, you'll go back to your regular state.
Drink. You will have a taste of my power, the strength of 100 men, the speed of a falling star, dominion over the night and all its creatures, to see and hear through their senses. Even heal grievous wounds.
At what price?
Once you drink, your thirst for human blood will be insatiable. But if you can resist for 3 days, you will return to your mortal state, having sampled my power and perhaps saved your people.
And if I feed?
The price would be worse than if you'd never stepped in here. For I will be set free, having granted the darkness a worthy offering. You will become its vessel, as I am. A scourge on this earth, destined to destroy everything you hold dear. Your land, your people, even your precious wife and son.
I would die before I harmed them.
Indeed you will, I'm afraid. I, however, will at last be free to unleash my wrath against the one who betrayed me. And one day, I will call on you to serve me, my pawn, in an immortal game of revenge.
This is not a game!
Oh, what better way to endure eternity? For this, little prince, is the ultimate game. Light versus dark, hope versus despair, and all the world's fate hangs in the balance.
And it will be my great pleasure to disappoint you.
Drink.
And so he goes for that bargain. He drinks the blood. He becomes a vampire. And then he uses that power to fight against the Turks, but he fights with this hunger. So that's kind of that was the novel thing I thought was pretty cool about. This is almost like, you know, his test or whatever. He has to go 3 days without drinking the blood of another human. And he's sure that he can do that. And so he, to save his country and his family, he takes that risk and fights for his people. And I thought that was a pretty cool premise for the story. I'd never heard anything like that. And especially the 3 days I thought was a really good device for storytelling, that you could really see the temptation that he goes through for those 3 days. And he does, and they did a good job with that part, I thought.
Yeah, I agree. The Faustian bargain that he makes with, we're going to call this guy the master vampire, is really fascinating, because the holy man in the palace tells him about the legend of this creature that's sort of damned to be, he's stuck in this cave and he lives among the darkness, and, you know, and he's horrible. And if he ever were to escape, it would bring a new level of darkness upon the earth. And the deal he makes, Vlad makes with this vampire, is if he can hold out for 3 days, then the master has to stay in the cave and everything will go back to normal. And they show that there is temptation, and like he looks at his wife and he can see the vein in her neck pulsing. And, you know, your hate has made you powerful, kind of thing. When he's out there, the bloodlust starts to come upon him, and ooh, you know, just take a little bit. Oh, yeah, yeah. And I like that there's this the sword of Damocles hanging over the prince, that if he slips, then all is lost. But if he's too careful, then he won't be able to stop the Turkish invaders. And there's thousands of them. And even though he's a great warrior, you know, he wouldn't stand a chance against thousands of them. The crux of the movie is that bargain that he makes, and him wanting there to be peace and sort of being forced into war once again. And I really like that, because he's got advisors and he's got his wife. He's got a young son. They all know what he used to be and what the world used to be just a few years before, when it was all war. And now they're enjoying peace. And here comes the Sultan to take that peace away again. And he has to make that decision earlier, is if he gives, did you say it was 1,000 boys?
Yeah, that was what he was told.
If he gives the Sultan 1,000 boys, then his people will be safe. But, you know, his people lose 1,000 boys. And it's an unanswerable question of what you do. And when he hesitates, the Sultan, who is just they cast Dominic Cooper as the Sultan, and so you know what a bastard he is. And yeah, he demands that Vlad send his son as well. And so it's just like, oh, shoot. Maybe all of my people will die if I don't make this deal for 1,001 boys. But isn't 1,001 boys too high a price to pay for peace? They do really, really great world building at the beginning of this movie, because they establish that when he was part of the Ottoman Empire and living in the house of the Sultan, that the Sultan favored him and was impressed by him. And the Sultan's real son, that Dominic Cooper plays, was envious.
Right.
And was never able to measure up. And I think that's part of why the Sultan is so nasty and played by Dominic Cooper when he's a grown-up, is because of that jealousy or whatever. And now it's my time to, I don't know, to hurt or to be more powerful than Vlad.
To get his revenge.
All of this stuff felt like they were adapting a book, where if you read the book, you would get all of these details of what his life was like before and stuff. And instead you get Hidian a couple of lines of dialogue and a tiny little prologue that shows him out on the battlefield impaling the enemies of the Turks, you know, as this bloodthirsty warning, do not mess with the Ottoman Empire or this might happen to you. I thought that that was really cool. And then he comes back and he's put all that behind him. I think he had like this blood red armor that he was wearing in that first scene. And then he locks it away and he's like, I'm not that man anymore. And you know how movies work. He's going to have to put that armor back on again. He's going to have to become the Impaler once again. But they do it not as a horror movie. They do it as like an action, epic, superhero movie.
They even have the, you know, the part there after he wakes up after dying and becoming a vampire, where he's learning all of his new superpowers, you know, his super hearing and his speed and his healing and all this stuff, you know, and then eventually he learns to control the animals of the night or whatever. Yeah, during that part, I was like, yeah, this is pretty much just like Spider-Man, figuring out he can climb walls and jump over cars and shoot webs and all that kind of stuff. And they didn't, well, I guess that's right in the middle of all the superhero craze, right? With all the Marvel movie success. I mean, that's, they probably sought out to do that.
And yeah, now might be a time to talk about that. That this was Universal's first attempt to bring Dracula back under the guise of a shared universe. This was going to be the first installment in their new Avengers-type movie series, where you're going to have a Dracula movie, and you're going to have an Invisible Man movie, and you're going to have a Jekyll and Hyde movie, and you're going to have a Creature from the Black Lagoon movie, and a Wolfman movie, and I'm sure I'm missing something, Frankenstein movie. And there were hopes that this would, you know, be the first installment, and they'd have Luke Evans back in the modern era as Dracula, and maybe an anti-hero kind of thing. I don't know. Because there's never a moment, except for toward the very end of the movie, where you think, okay, this is a bad guy now. He's the villain of the piece.
Right.
He's very heroic, and even when he's got that bloodlust upon him, where he's like, oh, I need to drink the blood, he finds a way to prevent himself from stepping over that line. And in some ways, it sort of reminded me of Doctor Strange, where there was a character and he went to a faraway land to get this power that he needed. And maybe not, but eventually the Sultan has gotten his whole army to come, and they're going to attack the palace, or they're going to attack Transylvania. And it's basically Dracula versus, geez, do they say how many?
No.
Soldiers?
No, I don't think they ever do. It just seems endless.
An infinite number of soldiers. I mean, so many soldiers that a lot of time they're computer generated. there was a moment right before it all fell apart where he goes out and he uses his powers to kill all these dudes. And it's heroic. It's not horrifying. It's not scary. It's not tragic. It's fairly bloodless, not really even violent. It's PG-13, Iron Man taking out a bunch of terrorists, or Captain America fighting a ton of Hydra soldiers, that kind of thing. And then the rest of the movie happens. And I think, maybe I should have asked you what you thought of the movie before we started, because I'm just steamrolling over you. But before I ask what you think of the movie, there was a scene where the Turkish army is all afraid of Dracula. And yeah, of course they would be. This guy can turn into bats and then fly around and reform as a human being. That's something I don't know that we've ever seen before, but he turns into like a swarm of bats. He's unstoppable. And because the Turkish army is afraid, the Sultan says, very well, all of you put blindfolds on, and I will lead you into Transylvania with blindfolds on so you can't see this monster or whatever. And I was like, what? Really? I still can't believe that was in a movie. You see all of these extras with blindfolds on, and they're marching.
And he threw some dialogue in there like, when you learned how to march blindfolded when you were children, or whatever. You know, they had some line in there like that, like they've been taught this for years how to do this. I just thought that was kind of strange. So what point did the movie turn and go downhill for you?
Well, no, I think I just said that blindfolded scene is so ridiculous and so dumb that I was just like, oh.
Okay, that was it. Okay.
And again, we're not going to leave any spoiler unturned. He makes it through the 3 days, and then the Sultan sends like some of his master assassin dudes, his lieutenants or whatever, and they like sort of sneak up and they catch the prince and they catch Marina. Is that her name?
Marina.
Okay, Marina. And Vlad shows up just in time and he kills these dudes, but she falls off of a tower. His wife falls and he jumps to save her, right?
Yes.
And I feel like he was a second too late, or he's not able to catch her in time, right?
It was a Gwen Stacy moment.
It was a Gwen Stacy moment, but like the Amazing Spider-Man 2, it was not handled well. She falls, and I guess she's broken on the ground, and she says, "You need to drink of my blood." And that's his breaking point. That's his temptation. That's whatever it is. That's when he chooses to lose his soul, I guess.
Yeah, because she's...
He gives in to the temptation, but it's for logic purposes, or it's because of... Help me out. Why did he do it?
She goes, "I'm already dead." I mean, I don't know how she survived that anyway, but she's like, I'm already gone. I'm going to die. But our son is still with Mamed. You have to save our son. And the only way you can do that is with the power of darkness or whatever. And so that's why he does it, to go save his son.
There's still time for you to stop that. Drink my blood.
No. I cannot take your life.
My life is lost already. But our son's is not.
So there is a reason. The Sultan has made off with his only son. And early on, I did like there was a line where they said, "You are young. You can make more sons."
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If you're viral.
Give us this one and go make some more. Look at your wife, for goodness sake. Anyway, he doesn't feel that way. He really loves this boy. And so I guess he drinks of her blood, and then he fully becomes a creature of the night. And these scenes where he is the vampire, the you know, going against innumerable foes, I was reminded of the problem with DC superheroes. And when I saw Aquaman recently, there's a scene early on, they go aboard like a nuclear submarine, and there's all these terrorists, and just, you know, who cares how many of them there are, they go against this one man. Well, whatever Aquaman is. I guess he's a demigod or a half... What is Aquaman?
Atlantean.
Okay, so he's half Atlantean, but he's so insanely overpowered that none of them stands a chance, that all of them don't stand a chance against him, and the tension is gone. There's no danger, there's no worry that maybe our good guy will fall. He's just too powerful. And, you know, the DC superheroes have really good points to them, but this negative point can ruin tension and can ruin drama. And that seems to be the case with Dracula. Once he becomes the vampire Dracula, there's no, like, Ironmonger or Abomination or Red Skull on the other side who is equally powerful. They're just men, and so you know inevitably what the solution is going, what the result is going to be when he goes after them, and I felt like, dang, man, it's a shame that I don't care anymore. That you can throw innumerable CG guys at the Count, and he just doesn't, they don't make a scratch.
Especially when he was doing his bat bending, or whatever that was.
But in the back of my mind, and maybe in yours too, I knew that, well, the Sultan isn't the true villain of this movie. He's released the master vampire from the cave. Charles Dance plays this ancient evil, and Charles Dance is wonderful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was one of the best parts of the movie.
And so the whole time you're thinking, but that's okay. That's okay. Okay, more CG, more armies, more... Okay, that's cool because I know that the big fight is coming. I know that the big bad is actually the master vampire. And that's coming. And so okay, if you guys want to get out... This movie would have been fine at a lower budget, but okay, no, keep giving a set piece. Oh, bigger. Wow. All right. That's great. But the movie ends after he takes out the Sultan. I guess there is a subplot where he transforms a bunch of his Transylvanian people, whatever you call it.
Yeah, they all become vampires, right?
And he turns them into vampires as well. And so it makes it even easier to destroy the Turkish Empire, or the army. But then at the end of the movie, he decides, I guess we are creatures of the night, we are beings of evil, I need to kill all of these other vampires. But there's never the question of this master vampire being out there. This is a great evil, and this was prophesied in books, and the religious people warned me about this, and this was the reason I was not to take blood. That it never comes up. So when he heroically decides to die and take his vampire spawn with him, the whole time I'm just like, whoa, 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 don't do that. Because Dr. Evil is still out there, Austin, or whoever we're coming up with, where there's an arch enemy out there. Who will save the world from this thing if you die? That never comes up. Although you just saw the movie, maybe it does. Help me out here.
It doesn't, really. They never talk about, except for the very last scene, which is kind of like a, even though it's before the credits, it's kind of like an after credit scene, where it's modern day in England, and the Count is just walking around the streets, and he sees a woman that looks exactly like Marina, probably supposed to be reincarnated or whatever. And he starts to flirt with her, and they kind of walk off together. And then you see Charles Dance looking like a regular human sitting in a chair. And then he stands up and kind of follows after them. And he says, well, let the games begin. And that's how they end it.
He says that to the camera. You know, he winks at the camera, right?
Well, I don't think he actually winked, but I mean, he might as well have.
No, I mean, he doesn't literally wink, but it's to us. And... I was just like, oh, okay, well, I guess that's, they're setting up, I don't know. Because there were a couple of lines that hinted to our love is timeless and endless and maybe we all reincarnate and, you know, love is eternal, as you've seen in so many terrible Dracula movies.
Right.
And I guess it was building toward that, but that end scene was so anticlimactic to me. I didn't want it to end in modern time when it felt like there was more story to be told in the past. The story was narrated by the son, by the boy?
Yeah, the beginning and end was his narration.
I guess everybody assumes that Vlad has died at the end of the movie, and so his son becomes king or prince or whatever,
right?
The leader of Transylvania, and Vlad died a hero protecting us, I guess. I don't know. I really felt like the movie fell apart in the last half hour or so. And there was this neat sense of epic scope to the first of the movie,
yeah,
where it was just like, oh my goodness, they're doing a biopic on Dracula by the makers of Braveheart, Dracula Untold kind of thing. It's like one of those movies you see where they ran out of money and suddenly everything is tied up and everything is fixed and everything is fine and the credits roll, but Skeletor pops up out of the water and says, I'll get you, He-Man. And you're like, but I don't know, dude. You guys ran out of money and who cares now? That's how I felt. I was really disappointed by the ending of this movie or by the last bit of this movie.
Well,
it's too bad because when it worked, it really worked.
It did. Yeah. Well, I think it just, you know, since it was trying to take on the superhero thing, it took it on a little too much and did the old third act cave in at the end kind of thing. But I guess in the weird, you know, they had this big battle between Dracula and the Sultan, and the Sultan all of a sudden knows everything about vampires. And he says, oh, I know you can't deal with silver. And he has silver coins all over the floor, and he has silk bags.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I forgot about that scene. And that scene was awful, dude.
Yeah, that was bad. I mean,
because no exaggeration, how many coins would you say the Sultan had?
Oh, thousands.
It would make Scrooge McDuck vomit how many coins this guy had. But again, you never feel like Vlad is going to lose.
Yeah.
They don't. I don't know why they didn't weaken him to the point where, you know, just like where he becomes like a corpse and he can barely stand and all that stuff. But it's the cries of his son telling him, get up, Dad, get up, that makes him find the strength to stand up and keep fighting. It just, even then, even with 100 billion coins pouring down on him, he was still Superman.
Yeah.
And I just, thank you for reminding me about
that. Yeah, that was his kryptonite. Yeah.
Because, yeah, when he goes to confront the Sultan has like a silver sword. And when he pulls it out, there's like kind of a neat effect on the sword, like it glows.
Yeah.
And that weakens Vlad. But it only weakens him so that instead of having the power of He-Man, he has the power of Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Right.
And so it just, yeah, I don't know. I feel like that was a missed opportunity as well. And that maybe a filmmaker who knew what he was doing could make you think, oh, he might not actually make it. Well, this may be the end of Count Dracula. It just, it was always too lopsided.
Yeah, the point where it fell, I mean, I kind of liked the, even though it was strange that he would give everything up at that moment, you know, when his wife is about to die, I did like the fact that he told her the truth from the beginning, and she was supporting him, and his son figured it out. He says, when you refused to give me the Turks, that's when you got sick, didn't you?
You'll make a great leader someday. You think of others before yourself.
When the Turks came to take me, you stopped them. That's why you got sick, isn't it? Save me.
Yes. And I would do it all again.
And so they were behind him. They supported him. And even at the end, you know, she's like, you have to save our son. Take me, you know, take of my blood or whatever. So I could have gone with that. But then making everybody a vampire and going after the Turks and then they're all vampires. That's kind of where I was like, all right, it's not about him anymore. It's about monsters, you know, the vampires like zombies almost, you know. But then when he gets done, defeats the Sultan, then the vampires want the son's blood because he's a human now. They don't like humans. They're just their food. And so the priest comes with his crucifix and protects the boy, which I guess is kind of neat that the priest is there to help, but it kind of had lost its savor at that point.
Well, and they didn't have it be sort of a Hulk type thing where this power makes him mindless or makes him dangerous to the people that he loves. You never say, oh, please don't give in to your power. It's not seen as like a negative thing. And I feel like that was a mistake as well. It was like Billy Batson becoming Captain Marvel or something like that. It's like, there's no reason not to do it. And the boy, I don't think, sees that his dad is a murderer and judges him about it. You know, he doesn't feel like it doesn't feel like he's going to lose his son because he becomes this monster. It just, there was no downside to the curse or the gift or whatever. But it felt like they were threatening that when Charles Dance in the cave was talking about his half-life and his existence in that cave.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, I guess we're talking a lot about this movie, but I feel like its potential was great. And the end result was not. It got a 23 on Rotten Tomatoes. It did make some money.
Yeah, worldwide it got...
It did $213 million.
Yeah.
How did it do here?
56.
You know, $56 million doesn't seem like that bad either. But... yeah, Universal sort of dropped the whole, this is the first installment in our new Marvel Universe. And they started from scratch with a new version of The Mummy starring Tom Cruise. And maybe we could talk about that sometime. But that was, yeah, supposed to be the first installment in their Dark Universe film series. And they had Dr. Jekyll in that. And they had a logo at the beginning, like Marvel Studios or DC. And The Mummy was just awful.
It was bad.
And I mean, it was a huge flop. It was one of those that people talk about as a giant failure when, you know, they were expecting it to be successful. And it had a 15 on Rotten Tomatoes, the Mummy. I feel like this was a better movie than the Tom Cruise Mummy. But
yeah, I'd say a lot better.
But still, it's just a shame. Because I liked the idea of another shared universe. I mean, I'm a big fan of those old Universal monster movies. And when, you know, Frankenstein and the Wolfman were in the same movie, or Frankenstein and Dracula and the Wolfman were in a movie. I mean, it's just, that was really neat that they could do that and that they were all sort of set in the same universe. And as far as I know, nobody had done that before them, before the Universal in the 1940s, I guess it maybe the late 30s. And so, you know, it's just like to bring that back and to say, hey, we're going to do a new Invisible Man, and we're going to do a new Mummy, and we're going to do a new Dracula, and we're going to do a new Bride of Frankenstein. I was just like, oh yeah, count me in. I will go to see all of that stuff because I loved the old films. But I don't imagine that's going to happen now, that they were going to do a Bride of Frankenstein, where Angelina Jolie was going to play the bride of the creature. And I want to say Javier Bardem was going to be the creature, the Frankenstein's monster.
Oh.
But that never happened. Johnny Depp was going to be... Who was Johnny Depp going to be?
I think he was going to be the Invisible Man, wasn't he?
Okay, there you go. I think so. And yeah, they just... They got ahead of themselves. And once again, I mean... Yes, The Mummy is a bad movie, but if it had been a cheap, responsibly made bad movie, we wouldn't care. We'd be like, well, you guys can skip that first movie, but you need to see Frankenstein, you need to see Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, or whatever came later. But when you spend as much money as they did on that movie, well, sorry, you don't get another chance at this.
Yeah, I would have much rather seen, even with its flaws, I would much rather see a franchise grow from this movie, Dracula Untold, than I would The Mummy. And I guess nothing in The Mummy negated anything from Dracula Untold, but you could have something where, you know, the master vampire, Charles Dance, is like the Loki character, you know, where he's planning something big.
Ah, where a bunch of monsters have to team up to fight this greater monster.
Or something like that. That would have been a really good way to do it.
But. Yeah, I think that would have been neat. You know, the 2017 Mummy is so forgettable and bland and just it's a non-starter. But this movie, this Dracula movie, really had a lot of potential and some really cool ideas in it. It's not as forgettable. You don't shrug this off quite as much. And because I had that experience with my friend's wife, they end the movie with, you know, that he's Dracula, son of the dragon, and that he embraces that, no, I am Dracula, son of the devil.
Right.
You know, it's just like, I have embraced that I am evil incarnate, and anyone who faces me will face evil incarnate. And it's sort of like, I am Iron Man.
That's true.
You know, it's just like yes, the press release has gone out. Let's change this one word on the press release. And all who face me shall tremble. And I thought that was cool, too. It just reminded me of my friend's wife saying, of course, you know, he would embrace this thing so that his enemies would fear him.
Right.
If I had to bet money, I would bet that scene with Charles Dance and Sarah Gaydon in London was shot later and it was tacked on because it just didn't feel right to me. But although, like I said, there were lines about ours is a love that will last forever and all that stuff. Maybe they just had seen enough vampire movies where Dracula had his one lost love. And then 100 years later, 200 years later, he runs into her again. That they was like, oh, well, let's put that in here. And then they felt like they had the opportunity to cash in on that promise by saying, well, we'll cast the same woman as Mina Harker in the modern day.
Yeah. But it just didn't work.
Are you a big Dracula fan or vampire movie fan?
Yes and no. I mean, like, I love the book, Dracula. It's one of my favorites. It's, you know, I love the format. I love anything that's written, you know, with journal entries and letters and all that stuff. Epistolatory format or whatever. I love that stuff. And just, it does a really good job of building everything. And you have that dread and that terror and all that kind of stuff going on. I don't remember. I was trying to find my book, but I could. It must be in a box somewhere, still packed. But I was thinking back to Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula, and they talk about him being Vlad the Impaler in there, kind of at the beginning, and how he came back, and his wife had killed herself because she thought he was dead, and that's why he thought God had betrayed him, so he went totally into darkness and became the vampire or whatever. But I don't remember if the book talks about him being Vlad the Impaler or not.
I don't believe so. We get almost no history on who he is in the book because, you know, where would it come from?
True.
Abraham Van Helsing writes a letter to somebody and says, you know, this is what I have uncovered about the Count. A lot of it is just a mystery. They don't really know who he is or you know, what his purpose is. And that's part of what makes him so scary in that book. It's all told from the point of view of people who are afraid of him.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point.
And boy, I really love that book too. I'm surprised that you do, just because it's not a book that a lot of people have read. But it's super readable. It's not nearly as dated as some of the things from the 19th century. I mean, it was 1897, and so it's practically the 20th century. But still, I feel like that book totally holds up.
It does.
It's enjoyable.
It does.
Whereas other classics from that era, you just kind of have to know about the norms of the time, or you just kind of have to put modern day rules out of your mind to be able to enjoy it.
Yeah, it's great stuff. But as you know, as far as am I a fan of vampire movies, I was thinking about that, and every Halloween or October, I've been trying to go back because I don't know the classic movies very well, and so I did Frankenstein last year, and then this year I watched some of the Wolfman and the Mummy, but I haven't got to the Dracula ones yet from the classic movies. So, you know, my reference to vampire movies are like The Lost Boys and Fright Night and, you know, those types of things.
Stuff from the 80s.
Stuff from the 80s. So, you know, it takes those tropes and tries to do something different and fun with them. And I liked those movies, but I guess the vampire thing, I wasn't, had to go see the next vampire movie. I did see Salem's Lot. I haven't read the book, which I probably should.
The 1979 Salem's Lot, the TV movie?
Yeah. So I did enjoy that.
Yeah, that's really, really good.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good movie.
I saw that in 2019. That's how recently I saw Salem's Lot. And I feel like it holds up as much now as it did when I was a little boy. And I was so scared by the floating vampires outside the window as a little boy. Oh my gosh. And today, seeing it now, I can see that they have somebody like on a gimbal and that they shot it in reverse, because you can see like smoke moving, getting smaller. And what do you call that? Instead of dissipating, it is coalescing and stuff like that. But it doesn't make that effect less alien or less frightening, knowing how they did it. But anyway, yeah, I am a big fan of vampire movies and of Dracula movies. I like them. For a long, long time, Dracula and Tarzan were neck and neck of like the most adapted fictional characters.
Oh.
But I think Sherlock Holmes has passed both of them now.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess I never put those two together, Tarzan and Dracula. But yeah, see, I've never seen the Christopher Lee ones or, you know, any of that. And I'm sure you've seen all those.
I have. And that, you know, they're varying levels of enjoyment. But I would suggest you watch the 1958 one, which is the first Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing one, because it is an actual adaptation of Bram Stoker's book.
Oh.
And it's a little closer to the book than the 1931 one with Bela Lugosi is. But I don't think that there has been an entirely faithful adaptation of that book yet. There was a one in the 70s with Jack Palance.
Oh, that'd be good.
That, and I believe they called it Bram Stoker's Dracula in like 1970, let's say 74.
Mm.
And then, yeah, Coppola's movie in 92, if I had to guess.
Yeah, I think that sounds right.
Called itself Bram Stoker's Dracula. But it included all that nonsense of Mina being the incarnation of Dracula's lost love. And I don't know why they keep doing that. That's not in the book. It serves to humanize Dracula. It serves to make him an anti-hero or a hero or a romantic figure. And I like the ones where it's just like, he is an unholy thing. And he's not a man at all. He's something less than a man. Because that's what he was like in that book. And it was scary.
Yeah, I'll have to read that again. It's been a while.
Yeah, I'm assuming that there is an audiobook where they've done like full cast. Because, you know, the story is told from Jonathan Harker's diary and somebody's letter to so-and-so and a newspaper article, and, you know, and it would work really, really well as a full cast. You know, each chapter is narrated by a different person.
It would be, yeah. And that's where I thought they did write in this movie with the Charles Dance vampire. You know, I really like that scene where him and Vlad are in the cave and he's trying to tell him sort of what it's like to be a vampire. You know, he's lived in there for thousands of years. The vampire knows Vlad. He's watched him and he calls him the Impaler. And so you know that he knows what's happened and everything, what he's done. And then Vlad's talking about, you know, I did that to save more people because men don't fear swords as much as they fear monsters. I became the monster in order to save more people, to make them terrified so they wouldn't have to be conquered. I just was eating it all up at that point.
Thousands.
And when you put them to the stake, what did you feel? Shame? Horror? Power?
Answer me! Nothing. I felt nothing. A greater crime than the act itself.
Then why spill blood if not for the pleasure of it?
Because men do not fear swords. They fear monsters. They run from them. By putting one village to the stake, I spared 10 more. Sometimes the world no longer needs a hero. Sometimes what it needs is a monster.
And you believe you know what it is to be a monster? You have no idea. But I'm going to show you.
I did watch an interview with Charles Dance where he was talking about the character, and you know, they asked him if he wanted to be a vampire. He says, well, not just any vampire, but tell me more about it, kind of thing. And then he said he wanted him to be creepy and reptilian and disgusting, you know, not to be this charming kind of vampire guy. And I think they succeeded with that. They did a great job with him. But look, you're right, though. You know, it would have been even better if he was the big bad, or Vlad realized what he had really done. Instead of just getting vengeance on the Sultan, he had unleashed a great evil into the world. Because the Master Vampire even says something like, I'm going to leave this cave, I'm going to vanquish my enemy, or whatever. I mean, he had plans for what he was going to do when he left the cave. So that would have been a bigger threat than silver coins and silver armor and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I don't know if they had a different vision for the movie and then they sort of abandoned that vision, or, you know, they had plans for a sequel that still took place in the past where we would pick up this great battle and it would be a good vampire versus an evil vampire, any of that stuff. But I don't remember seeing the Master Vampire like lurking about, or any hints that he was still out there throughout the second half of the movie. Once the curse was lifted or whatever and he could leave, he was a forgotten plot element.
Yeah, the only thing I could think of is that they were setting him up to be the person that they fought in the other films, upcoming films, that he would be the big evil that they'd all have to gang up and fight against. But,
and, you know, that's sort of a superhero thing, too. They could have set up the movie where, in the final scene, he escapes, sort of like General Zod escaping from the Phantom Zone. And that was how the 1978 Superman was supposed to end.
Sure, yeah.
Superman threw this missile out into space that was headed for Hackensack, New Jersey, and it just happens to free the Phantom Zone villains. And now we've got something for the sequel.
Yeah.
And you know, it didn't work out that way, but I feel like that totally could have worked in this movie, and you could have actually had promise of more of, you know, son, I can't be the prince anymore. I can't rest and be a normal man. My actions have caused a great shadow to move over not only this country, but all the world, and I can't rest until I've fixed this wrong. And there's the end of your movie.
Oh, I like it. I like
it's
it.
It's just...
Let's write the screenplay.
It feels like there is a really good movie in this film instead of a pretty good movie. Would you say Dracula Untold was a pretty good movie?
Yeah, I would say that. Yeah. I enjoyed most of it.
And yeah, one last thing. Luke Evans, we didn't really talk about him. I really like this guy, Luke Evans. He's young and sort of square-jawed, but he seemed talented enough that you felt like he was a caring, breathing, feeling person. Maybe a more sensitive action hero. It's a shame that he didn't get a chance to, you know, to do this, to have a franchise where he could come back every couple of years. He was in those awful Hobbit movies, I remember. I know he's been in other stuff, but I don't think he's ever been able to shine. Say again?
He was Gaston in the live-action Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, okay. Well, everybody but me saw that, so I guess that is a successful film that he was in. But I still don't feel like anybody has let this guy shine in a movie where you're just like, oh, yeah, Luke Evans, he's the guy that's in... Yeah, maybe people do say he was Gaston in the 2017 Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
But anyway, I wanted to mention that. And then the girl, I had seen her in one other thing, and it's just like, I told you when I called you halfway through the movie, why isn't this girl in everything?
Yeah, she was good. Well, I guess lessons learned from this would be...
Don't cast Dominic Cooper in your movie. That's the lesson.
That's what it is. Yeah, this is two movies now, Warcraft and...
It's always more fun to talk to you about a movie that makes you think where there was potential for something good or where there was something good than when... I mean, maybe not. I mean, if you and I did an episode about The Avengers from 1998... or for Batman and Robin from 1997.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Maybe we'd have nothing to say. Sorry. Maybe we'd have tons of hilarious comments to say about those awful movies that have no redeemable qualities. But, you know, we've gotten an hour out of this because there was some interesting stuff going on.
Yeah, there was good and bad in this one. Well, we probably exhausted everything we can talk about there.
Sure.
I think, I don't know if you agreed to this, but I was thinking the next movie we could talk about is a movie that came out last year that I don't think anybody heard of. I didn't hear about it. The only reason I knew about it is because there was an old cardboard stand-up of it at a theater that I went to. But it's a science fiction movie called Kin, and I really don't know anything about it, but I thought that's a movie that... we could watch and find out why nobody knows about it or how it even came to be.
Yeah, you had mentioned that to me, and I went to Target, and they had it, and I saw that Dennis Quaid was in it.
Oh.
And I thought, oh, I like Dennis Quaid. When did this come out? And I like read the back, and it's like, this is not familiar at all. This poster is not familiar. I have no idea. Yeah, this movie came out in 2018 theatrically. And I never heard about it. And it's pretty rare for there to be a movie that you didn't even hear about.
I never saw a teaser for it or a trailer for it or anything. So I thought that might be fun to bring out and let people know about it.
Okay, well, yeah, we can definitely talk about that in the next episode or in a future episode. And let people know how they can suggest movies to us. Maybe people know of a sleeper movie that nobody has heard of that's great. You got to check this out. This movie is really cool. Or, you know what movie I saw and really, really disappointed me? And, you know, because if people suggest things and you and I can get together and do this on a regular basis, it's fun.
It is. See, something like I would have never watched Dracula Untold. I never would have watched Warcraft. So it's kind of fun to do that. So yeah, if you do have suggestions or you want to talk about your feelings about this movie or any other things that we talk about, you can send an email to journeyintopodcast@gmail.com. You can look up Journey Into on Facebook or Twitter. These episodes at this point are only available on Patreon. So I guess you can message me through Patreon. And yeah, we'd love to hear your feedback. I think somebody did suggest a movie a while back, and I'll have to go back and look and see what that was. But yeah, the more the merrier. And I think we will put another poll up to have the Patreon members pick which movie they want us to talk about. But I wanted to have some of these, you know, we'll probably do a mix. Things that you want to see, things that I want to see, things that the Patreon members want us to see, and go on from there. So
they don't eventually become available for other people. It's just Patreon.
Yeah, I might. Somebody says, I think Rob has suggested that maybe when we do a new one, I put out on the public podcast.
The old one.
The old one that I had done.
Yeah, that's a really good idea, I think.
So I might end up doing that. I don't know. I was hoping, because I know there's some podcasts that I listen to. They do Patreon exclusive only podcasts. And
yeah, I hear you. But this is sort of a regular series. And you had said Comic Cave was only going to be for Patreons as well.
That's true. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I think if you release it late for people and they like it, maybe you'll get more Patreon subscribers, but if there's no way to listen to it unless they pay, I don't know. That's a quandary.
That's probably what I'll end up doing. So whenever our next one comes out, I'll put this one out on the feed or every other one or something like that.
Cool.
So yeah, unless you have any last words, Rish, I think we can call this one a wrap.
No, I have nothing more to say. Thank you for letting me be on your podcast and for watching a movie you wouldn't otherwise have watched for me. And yeah, let's watch yours next.
Sounds good. And to all you out there, hope you come back to watch another movie with us. And we'll try to get the, that's another thing I'll do is start to let you know what we're going to watch. So if you want to watch before you listen to our episodes, that would be another way to join us in the podcast.
Yeah, go ahead and release that information now. And by the time the episode is edited, anybody interested will have seen it.
All right. Well, I guess for now, I'm signing out. Marshall Latham.
I've been Rish Outfield.
Good night.
Good night.
The Unholy Outfield and the Infernal Latham and their wicked excursions are protected by a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives License, which offends me like silver. You may share this openly so long as you proclaim its origin. Be that as it may, if you should modify the audio in any way, or seek riches from its marketing, you shall be cursed even as I. Your thirst for human blood will be insatiable, and I shall be set free, having granted the darkness a worthy offering. You shall become its vessel, as I am, a scourge on this earth, destined to destroy everything you hold dear. Your lands, your people, even your precious loved ones. I, however, will at last be free to unleash my wrath against the one who betrayed me. And one day, I will call on you to serve me, my pawn, in an immortal game of revenge.
The love between Vlad and Marina, it's one of those timeless love stories. I mean, that's what we were trying to tap into. We were trying to tap into this idea of love everlasting, and it'll go on through the centuries. These are two people that found themselves and found each other in very difficult times and were there for each other. Reading back in Bram Stoker's novel, he had all these different powers that, you know, it's quite enviable to any modern superhero. It was power of strength, you know, the ability to disappear, turn into fog, move around a room at lightning speed, be able to transform into a creature or a beast of burden or an animal. There may be a public awareness there, but what do you bring to the table? What's going to be different? What's the soul of the film? Hopefully what's universal about the film is this idea of family. What one will do to what kind of sacrifices will you do in the face of incredible opposition? What will you do for your own family? And that for me was the personal appeal. And hopefully, I think, you know, people will understand it and they'll hopefully be able to connect with it.